Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Raul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Raul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, ELAWVATE.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net. And Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Gross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer. And you always want to keep up. And the best way to do that is with Expert Institute.
Welcome to the Elevate podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul is in trial today, so we'll look forward to hearing about the results of that in a week or two. I am very pleased today to welcome John Heenan of the law firm of Heenan and Cook from Montana to the podcast. Welcome, John.
Hey, good morning, Ben. I appreciate you having me. It's a pleasure to be here. As I was telling you, I listen all the time. It's awesome to get to visit with you in person.
Yeah, likewise. And before we get into the verdict, your recent verdict and some of your other cases, I'm heading out to Montana myself in a few weeks for a trip to Glacier. Any recommendations?
Yes, all kinds of recommendations we can get you on. Well, one, glad you're coming. That's a great place to be and a great time to come. And I'm kind of an amateur Montana tour guide, so arm me up with everything you need. We'll get you on the right rivers and all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. I can't wait. I haven't spent a ton of time in Montana, but it's just such a beautiful state. Somebody had invited me out to ski in Montana a couple winters ago, which was phenomenal. And I've never been to Glacier, so I'm really looking forward to it. I've seen some photos.
It's an incredible place.
Yeah. As long as I can avoid the grizzlies, I did purchase my bear spray online, so.
I think they get you on that one because they won't let you take it on the plane, and then you got to buy another can when you get here.
Oh, is that true?
Yep. I think there's a way you can, like, rent it when you get here. But definitely want your bear spray in Glacier Park, that's for sure.
Speaking of dealing with grizzlies, probably the second hardest thing to deal with in Montana is to be a plaintiff's lawyer. So we might share that a little bit, being in venues that are not all that receptive to plaintiff's cases or accustomed to returning big verdicts. But you've managed to have a bunch in your career and have some very successful results. So since you listen to the podcast, you know that we like to learn a little bit about our listeners before we get into cases. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get into this career trying cases in such a unforgiving state?
Totally kind of walked backwards into it. I went to University of Montana, graduated with a philosophy degree. My advisor told me I could be a bartender or a truck driver, stuff like that with my degree. So I was an over-the-road truck driver for about 2 years and went to all 48 states.
I'm a philosophy major myself, just so you know. I had the same life choices.
Yeah, so you had the same job options also. And then I was driving forklift after I got off the road and at a beer distributorship. And my wife was teaching and said, why don't you consider going back to school, but make sure there's a job at the end of the rainbow. And so I applied to law school. I thought I wanted to do environmental law. I did a summer internship in environmental law, and we were fighting over access and various, you know, the acronyms of environmental law, which is very worthy and noble path, but I realized quickly wasn't mine. The University of Montana Law School had a great clinical program, and so I was trying cases as a law student, and I was doing consumer protection stuff, so representing students on landlord-tenant and debt collection stuff, and quickly learned that I really liked being a trial lawyer and knew that was my path, and doing it ever since I graduated. Did some criminal defense when I started. That was really good. Got me into court a lot. I did the federal criminal defense. And so had probably over 30 civil jury trials, which is harder now than I think it was 20, 30 years ago to just kind of get in court and try cases. And, you know, when I lose or don't win as much as I think I should, I try and learn for the next one. And I read books. I love talking to people that, as you know, Ben, I mean, just, you know, trial lawyers like talking to trial lawyers and helping one another out and learning what works and learning what doesn't work and kind of adding to our toolkits. 8 years ago, I completely stopped practicing law. I ran for Congress, lost by about 2,000 votes, and restarted after that. So, you know, there was a restaurant in there for a minute. So all kinds of fun and excitement.
Well, that's interesting background. And your time in politics and talk, I assume that involved going around the state and at least your district. Do you have multiple districts in Montana? Or?
No. Well, we do now. We have two now. At the time, it was one. So it was a statewide race. So I think I put like 40,000 miles on my car in a year of campaigning, which was really good. With hindsight, glad I didn't win. I feel like I get more done doing what I do now than being in Congress, tweeting about things from DC. But I got to travel the whole state, you know, make connections and friends all over the place and become a better Montana tour guide.
I'm sure you also improved your ability to connect with people. And tell us a little bit about that. I mean, are there things you've learned in your career trying cases and also in your political experience that help you in communicating and persuading folks on a Montana jury? Is there a different approach you think that you need to do to connect with folks there?
I don't know about that, but I think it's easy for us all to kind of fall into shells where we only talk to other lawyers or, you know, people that drive cars like we drive. And if you get into that kind of cocoon and you start judging people that are outside that cocoon, it becomes pretty hard to talk to regular people or to other people. I do think law school, at least my experience in law school, was it like dehumanizes the process and trains you to like talk a language that's not normal human communication. And so I worked really hard back then to not embrace that, I guess, and not kind of give up talking like a regular person and, you know, not throwing around big words just because you might, you know, have learned them in school that day. And I think that is effective in politics. I think it's effective in life. Kind of the litmus test I have for cases going to trial, or really any case that I take, is, you know, if I can't explain it to my neighbors next door over a cup of coffee, and if it doesn't make sense to them and they're like, wait, why are you bringing this lawsuit? Then it's probably not a lawsuit worth bringing. That's kind of my tire kicker test, is like, you know, if you can tell the guy sitting next to you at the bar quickly what your case is about, and if they're not quickly like, that's bullshit, I'm glad you're bringing that case, then at least here in Montana, but I'd suggest probably everywhere, it's probably not a case worth bringing.
You mentioned you tried to learn from losses. What are some of the lessons you think you've learned and coming out of some of the losses? I hate to broach that painful subject for you, but I think it's one way we all get better.
Yeah, I had a bad faith one last year. I really thought we had him dead to right, and we got liability, but then we have this weird affirmative defense that we lost on, and I won't bore everybody with that. But and then I had another one where we got $2 million in punitives, but then the foreperson of the jury actually wrote in the Facebook online comments about the trial, you know, we wanted to give five, but we decided that was too much money. And if we gave five, then the defendant would appeal. So we reduced it to two so that the defendant didn't appeal. And of course, they appealed anyway. So learning from those, I did in this most recent case, I started closing before kind of getting into everything else. I told the jury a story about, you're probably familiar with an escape room, and like, you know, I've got four kids, and every year at Christmas, we go and do an escape room. And I told the jury about, you know, in the escape room, you get in the room and there's like the weird letter from Santa Claus, and it says something about Mrs. Claus's cookies, but every word in that letter has a hidden meaning, and you're looking around the room trying to figure out what the hidden meaning is. And I said, that's not what this is. The judge's instructions aren't designed to trick you. It's not your job to parse out hidden meanings. And then I just went through with them and I said, it's not your job to reduce the award that you think is fair because of things that you think might happen after. You know, many things have happened before, things will happen after. Like, your job's to be the appraisers. Don't think that there's some trick that you have to, you know, some mystery that you have to solve. Your job is to take the jury instructions and use your common sense. I've had defense lawyers kind of take that hill of common sense, and I always hate it when they do. And so I always, now from voir dire on, I'm always talking about common sense, collective common sense. You don't check your common sense at the door, because I do think that where I've had disappointing losses and I've talked to the jurors after, it's because one or two jurors wants to play, like, watch too many lawyer TV shows, and they want to be smarter than the judge and the lawyers and like find something that we didn't do. So I just think getting out ahead of that is critically important, and not letting that one smarty pants juror tank your case.
So that approach that you just described in your recent case obviously worked well, because the result was fantastic. I think you got a $27.7 million verdict. Can you just tell us a little bit about the case? What are the facts, the legal theories?
Yeah, it was assault in a private prison. Montana has one state-run prison and one private prison. The private prison is called Core Civic. They're all over the country. And basically, at that prison, a double homicide, life without parole guy who had assaulted multiple inmates while incarcerated, got out of his own pod, walked down the hall, got into my client's pod, which are both locked, went into his cell, shut the door, and beat and choked him for 3.5 minutes, and then left and got back out the way he came. And the jailers found him during cell count, and he was life flighted to the hospital in a coma for 5 weeks. the hospital suggested pulling the plug, which didn't happen. He ultimately came out of a coma, spent another 3 months in the hospital, and has severe and permanent brain injury in a really bad way. The quick down and dirty backstory is our client, Chad, was a college student, smart guy, developed schizophrenia in college, which is about the time that sadly that happens. Fell out of college, was homeless, living on the river in Montana as a homeless guy, kind of with a Jesus complex, and was charged with a crime. Judge didn't allow pretty critical evidence that would have helped him. He was convicted. This assault happened while he was in prison. He had no criminal background, had never been in jail before. And then the Innocence Project picked up his appeal. And after he had been assaulted, they overturned his conviction and he was released from prison. But now, of course, in a very bad, permanent injured way. So I was talking with my dear friend, Tim Bechtold, who he and I work on a lot of civil rights cases around Montana together. And he's super smart. And we were having a beer and he mentioned that he had a trial coming up in a couple weeks and asked if I could help him. And he let me help. And that was 4 weeks before trial started.
So you got into that right at the end. And in that case, you're able to bring claims against the private prison company under regular negligence theories. You don't have to pursue them as 1983 or civil rights claims.
Yeah, in 1983 and negligence, deliberate indifference, as I understand it. I don't do a lot of prison litigation, and I know that you guys had really smart guests last week that I was kind of a little intimidated by the Yale law and all that.
They were smart.
So it was one where I just kind of tried it as a negligence case, and I had never really had a case like that. I do a fair bit of assisted living type cases. And so I just kind of tried it like an assisted living facility case. And it was in federal court. So it was the way we did it anyway, is the alternate was allowed to deliberate also. Kind of both parties agreed to leave on the alternate. So it was seven jurors, unanimous verdict, and great result anywhere. But in Montana, as you mentioned, Ben, I mean, we are a red state. We have conservative jurors. It is not easy to get substantial damage awards from Montana jurors. And that is kind of one of the things that we all have to kind of work with where we are. And I love practicing law in Montana. I love being in front of Montana juries, but I have developed a way where it's really, there's no sympathy. I call out any effort to let sympathy creep in to the trial or the jury's verdict. And I just really try and do it from what's going to motivate a conservative juror to give a fair award.
What do you think motivated them in that case?
You know, hard to know, because in federal court, you're not allowed to talk to the jurors after. But our client was worthy. I think that's always the biggest thing. You know, we always think kind of it's our fault when we lose a trial, which I think isn't fair. When we have a big win, I think sometimes we give ourselves too much credit. I really think that kind of the magic formula is having a really good client that's going to present well to your jury. And then if you can sprinkle in some mean-spirited defense, lack of accountability, being mean to your client and disrespectful to the process, in my experience, that's what turns a good verdict into a great verdict.
Was there an element of the business model of the private security business? I'm curious how all that works. I mean, private prison.
There wasn't punitive damages available, so the whole award was compensatory. Their corporate representative gratuitously said in his examination that some people don't like the private prison model. And I was like, tell me more, you know, because I mean, I personally think it's a disgusting business practice where you have this for-profit company. It makes money by how many people are incarcerated, and literally has a huge part of its budget dedicated to lobbying politicians to allow more people in prison. Their stock's gone up like crazy since the whole ramp up of ICE. But that was the stuff that, like, every time I wanted to like make the case bigger, my wife and kind of smart people around me were like, no, don't, you know, just focus on this case. Don't make it bigger, which really worked well. So yeah, I think as we see in a lot of cases, they came in like, you know, screw you. We didn't do anything wrong. This is a joke. Every day after court, they were, you know, high-fiving and yucking their way out of the courthouse. And they were so confident that they sent their corporate rep home before deliberations. So they didn't even have a representative of the corporation to sit there and hear the jury verdict. Who knows what led to it?
Were there some moments in trial where, at least thinking back on it, you think were kind of turning points where the momentum might have shifted for you?
Yeah, I think they cross-examined our schizophrenic, brain-injured client for at least 2.5 hours, maybe 3 hours. And questions like, what part of the Bible made you choose to be homeless? And I was looking at the jurors like...
They actually asked that?
Yeah, yeah. And it's hard to get a read on jurors, but I'm like, if this is okay, then I'm in big trouble.
How did he respond to that question?
He gave him the Bible verse where Jesus said to go live with the people. I mean, I forget which verse it was, but that was... Mike Chad answered it like a serious question, not knowing because of his brain injury that the lawyer was basically mocking him in front of the jury. And I think the jury certainly understood that the lawyer was mocking him in front of them. And we all have our favorite trial books. Mine is Carl Bettinger's 12 Heroes. And it just kind of really presented kind of a great opportunity to part of my closing. I gave him this like, I talked about there's a reality show on ABC called What Would You Do? It's a hidden camera show. And I told the jury about, you know, that show, these bullying scenarios, and they see how many bystanders are going to get involved versus not get involved. And just really told them kind of this was not unlike that show where you've seen bullying play out right in front of you. And just like that show, you can pretend like you didn't see it and that it doesn't affect you, or you can do something about it. I mean, that's just kind of my version of copying Carl Bettinger's, his great way to present a case. But I really do think it's like, here's the villain. Here's how the villain has been doing something mean to this person. I can't help my client. The judge can't help my client. Only you can help my client. And I understand that you have nothing to gain by doing it, and I'd ask you to do it anyway. That's, in the simplest terms, kind of how to, I think, challenge a jury to do the right thing.
In that formulation, in your case, is the villain the defense team and the way they litigated the case, or is the villain the prison company and the way they didn't take care of him?
Yeah, the prison company, and, you know, and not from a punishment, and it was always talking about how do we compensate this guy for what happened to him, and understanding that we can't fix what happened to him. But I think calling out no accountability, we didn't do anything wrong. We owe this person nothing.
What did you say they did wrong?
Well, a couple things. I mean, they basically, we showed that as a cost-saving measure, the double homicide guy, there's this whole scoring system that's like where prisoners are supposed to be housed within the prison. And this guy was supposed to be in maximum security. And twice they overrided that scoring to put him in a lower security setting. So we said, kind of, first of all, these two people never should have crossed paths. But this company, because it gets paid per head, but it's more profitable to have its prisoners in a lower security setting. So that was one of the ways. And then we talked about how they didn't have eyes on this guy. There was video from the prison pod. Our guy knew that he was going to be assaulted for almost an hour. And he's like pacing around in his pod. They're supposed to go in and do a check. You can tell by the video that nobody goes in and does the check. And then when the assault guy walks down the hallway and in our guy's pod, he literally walked past two security, you know, correctional officers who like fist bumped him or somehow kind of interacted with him and kept walking.
Did he have a history with your client?
No, he didn't. He was just kind of the biggest, baddest dude. And I won't bore you with the whole background, but there was a misunderstanding. And, you know, so he went and kind of beat this guy into oblivion. And that was another thing too, you know, nobody had deposed the assailant. And so, you know, 4 weeks to go till trial, I was like, let's get this guy on the phone and see how he'd be, you know? And so we talked to the guy that assaulted our client, and 6 years removed now, he felt really bad. He was willing to testify. And kind of the big defense that they had was like, he had snuck into our client's pod. And he said, no way, man. There's no sneaking about it. You know, they just buzzed you right in. And that's how it always went. He told us that happened all the time at this prison, that people would buzz in and out of each other's cells to buy drugs, get tattoos, and assault other inmates. And so he was like our first witness. He actually, on his lengthy kind of rap sheet, one of the things in prison was that he had tested positive for methamphetamine. And so when we asked him, you know, on the stand, where'd you get the meth? He said, oh, I bought it from a prison guard. He painted a picture of that was contrary to the one that Four Civic was presenting. And, you know, we talked about, hey, wait a minute, this is a company that, you know, Montana contracted with to provide a safe environment for prisoners. This is how much they get out of that contract. Another thing that I think was kind of bad on the company's part was, you know, part of their contract that they get paid for is to provide mental health services. And they said, we don't even have a wing for people like this. Like, you know, he got no services at all. After the assault, they put him in a medical unit where they disregarded the hospital discharge. So he wasn't getting his, you know, his physical therapy and stuff like that. He talked about how he was given 1 hour a day to walk around with a walker and try and learn to walk again. I mean, it was just from start to finish, a pretty stark picture of a company that puts profits over caring for the people that it contracts to care for. So from voir dire on, I just kind of talked about it like same as an assisted living facility where somebody's paying money to this company to take care of a person. And to a conservative Montana jury, I mean, it's just guessing, but I think that kind of grabbed them as this is a company that isn't honoring its contract, isn't providing the services that it's getting paid to do.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
It's such a great result in a case that has a lot of merit. Now, what is the current status of that? Is it have they paid you? Are they up on appeal? Or I know you're smiling there because you would expect they're going to continue to fight for a while, I imagine.
Well, yeah, they filed, of course, motion for a new trial, and we argue that next week and then go from there.
Are they self-insured or they have coverage?
They have coverage, yep.
I don't think they have any facilities here in the Northeast that I'm aware of, but you said they're in a lot of different states?
Home base is Tennessee, I guess, and they are all over the place, and I think there's certainly a Texas facility. They do some of these immigration holds. I think they're making a lot of money now on being part of the ICE budget.
Seems like a business to be in at the moment with the money that's been appointed for that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to switch to philosophy with me or politics, Ben, I'm happy to, You know, I think capitalism works great for lots and lots of things, but prisons, caring for the elderly, educating children are maybe some of the things where hardcore capitalism often has, you know, some bad results.
Yeah, there has to be something that's valued more than the bottom line in those types of fields.
Yes.
But I assume, are you aware of any other cases? I'm assuming this company gets sued occasionally in different places.
Well, that's, I think they get sued a lot by pro se prisoners. And they just kind of brought this attitude of like, this is garbage. We deal with this all the time. I mean, basically they couldn't hide their disdain for prisoners, which is the population that get paid to serve. So I think that just really came across. So in this one, Chad, who is obviously, I mean, he has a very stunted walk. He talks very slow. He is obviously brain injured. I had him sit with us in voir dire. At the very beginning of voir dire, I basically got the jury panel's permission to exclude him from the trial. And I had him leave. And he didn't come back until he was our last witness. And I do think that that was effective.
What was your approach to putting him on the stand?
It was kind of last minute on whether we even wanted to call him at all. We ultimately had some, and I couldn't even remember what kind of the, you know, check the box. There was like two or three little things that we needed his testimony on. Tim's direct exam of him was 5 minutes, maybe less. I mean, just on and off, tell the jury this one. He wanted to say something also, you know, it was really important to him. This was his trial. But we basically got him on and off. And then, like I said, I mean, Core Civics, they just went hours of, they had surveillance video.
Did you expect that?
No, I didn't. And there were multiple times where it's like, do we stand up and object? Because they're really, you know, that it's obvious that they're being mean to our client. And it's, you know, hard in that moment to fight the urge and kind of say, I'm not going to intervene. I'm going to hope that the jury's going to intervene here and they see what's happening.
It's likely they would have called him even if you hadn't.
Yeah.
Because they had that game plan in mind.
100%. They had a surveillance video that was kind of comical. Chad said that it took him, I mean, he lives in the second floor of the Section 8 housing where he's got these spiral staircases he's got to navigate every time to get back and forth. And they asked him how long it took to get up and down, and he said a couple minutes, and they did that just so they could play a video of a surveillance of him leaving his apartment, and it took him like 58 seconds to get down the stairs. And then the lawyer goes, so you'd agree you lied when you told the jury it takes several minutes? And I mean, just stuff like that. I think the defense in their own echo chamber, they start high-fiving each other about stuff that they think is going to be really good gotcha moments. Another one, too, was in his deposition, he testified that he thought his damages were $2.5 million. And again, this is a guy with underlying schizophrenia and a serious brain injury. And then they tried to kind of beat him up in front of the jury about asking for $2.5 million. And so in closing, I just kind of said, they could have paid this guy $2.5 million 2 years ago when they took his deposition, but instead they invested in surveillance, defense lawyers, experts. You know, they said, we're going to use that money to fight this guy to the end. I'm like, so here we are. The time for compromise is over. And now we get to hear what you ladies and gentlemen think's fair.
Did you ask for a number? Or you can't do that in federal court, probably.
You can, or at least I hope you can.
Oh, you can?
I asked for $20 to $50 million. And I told the jury, I mean, just kind of wide, big guideposts or big goalposts. And I said that $3, $4, $5 million would not be enough money given my client's injuries.
And was there any kind of rubric or methodology you gave them to calibrate that, or just kind of left it to them with that wide range?
Talked about fair trade a lot, told them that they're the appraisers.
Were you doing any focus groups or anything that helped you kind of understand where this might come down?
We did one focus group. Elizabeth Larrick did it remotely. She's fabulous and really was helpful to get us honed in going into trial, and would highly, I'd certainly use her again and would recommend others do the same. I always do focus groups, and I always find that, in my opinion, the least effective thing is kind of what does your focus group think is damages? I mean, boy, if I had all the money that focus groups wanted to give me in my cases, I'd be talking to you from my yacht right now, probably. I mean, it's just, and you get all pumped up like, oh, this is going to be great. And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But how the jury got there, I don't know. Our special damages were about $120,000 in incurred medical bills and $1 million life care plan. The rest was general damages. But, you know, our guy was visibly and permanently injured.
I mean, that's got to be one of the larger verdicts in the history of Montana for an individual plaintiff.
I think for compensatory damages, it is. There's some really, really good trial lawyers in Montana who have gotten some really good verdicts, and there's been some good punitive awards, unlike some of our other states. You know, I do think jurors are open to awarding fair damages. So, but that was a good one. Yeah.
Well, maybe last topic for you. Over the course of your career and the many trials you've done, wins, losses, introspection, give us kind of your top couple things that you think other trial lawyers would benefit from in thinking about how to try a case. I know putting you on the spot that way is not easy, but.
No, I try to simple things like the way that you treat people in the courtroom and out of the courtroom. And if you don't have to put on a show, all the better. The jurors, especially now, think about what's the longest that we go without checking our phones. I mean, it's to have to leave your phone away for 2 hours while you sit in a courtroom. Like, that's a big deal now that it wasn't 15 years ago. So what they're watching is, how does everybody behave? How do you treat your paralegal? How do you treat your client? How do you interact with the court clerk? And so I think, know that the mic's always on, basically. And so behave appropriately, be a nice person in the courtroom, and hopefully be a nice person out of the courtroom, and respect their time. I think the quicker you can get in and get out, that really matters. We need to resist the urge to answer every what about that the defense throws at us, and trust the jurors to solve some of those things for us. And you know, yeah, I think be efficient with their time is hugely important. Like, every question, every break, every everything, like, they're going to punish you if they think you're wasting their time. And stick to your theme. I picked 4 things. Elizabeth was like, nah, do 3. And so we had 3 liability things. We hammered those and kind of never deviated from those 3 things. But that formula of build the system, explain how they broke the system, that seems to work well for me. And talking about money is always hard for me anyway. And I think if you're scared of it, so you don't talk about it, then you're kind of leaving your jurors high and dry. Whatever it looks like to you, you got to kind of come to terms with it. And another kind of, I stole from Brett Turnbull, who's an excellent trial lawyer. In voir dire, I just talked about millions and millions, and that's what we were going to be asking for, millions and millions, and just kind of use that as a refrain. And it was a good way to plan it without, for me, I don't want to stand up in voir dire and say, I'm going to ask for $20 million. It's just, in my opinion, too early. But talking about millions and millions was a way to kind of do it without setting a specific amount.
It's all great stuff. Well, congratulations again on that great verdict. It's a heartening result. And if any of our listeners have claims against the same private prison company, I hope they'll reach out to you to share some notes on that. And we really appreciate your coming on the podcast and sharing it with us.
Well, appreciate you having me, Ben. And for any of your listeners heading to Montana for fishing or skiing or anything, I love being in court, but I'd be lying to say I'd always rather be on a river fishing. So if anybody needs tips, reach out and I'll help hopefully point in the right direction.
And tell people how to get a hold of you.
john@lawmontana.com, or it's pretty easy on our website, which is lawmontana.com. easy to get a hold of. And I spend a lot of time. I've got lots of lawyer friends from around the country who we've taken out for fishing or hiking or something like that. So
where's your home base?
So I'm in Billings, and then I've got a cabin on the Boulder River, which is kind of my little slice of heaven, an hour and a half west of here.
I bet that's nice.
Yeah, it really is. So see if you can swing it, Ben, and we'll get you on the river.
Sounds great. I'd love that. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.